I'm Casper Wong, and I am, is this okay? And I am the founder of the Asian American Women Media Makers, and I'm going to be your host and the moderator this evening. We're a new group in town, so I would tell you a little bit more about who we are and why we're here in a moment. But to kick off, I really need to thank a lot of people. So we want to thank Ari for sponsoring the space for us. Without them, we won't have a home. And Joyce Moy, especially the executive director of this organization, has been extremely supportive. I won't go any further until I thank my panelists for coming. Again, for the new kid in town, you're just calling in every favor and every friend you have to help support this mission. So thank you, all panelists. We thought we would pass out the cards in a little bit and not introduce you in your professional capacity yet.
Anonymous.
Yeah, secret identities. Secret identities. So the panelists, and I want to thank our co-sponsors. We have five co-sponsors this evening, including Asian Cinevision is here. I think John Wu. John is in the back. And please feel free to go up to them afterwards if you have questions about any of these organizations. We have also KoreanAmericanStories.org. Is Pearl here? Or anybody representing them? Yeah, Pearl Park. She should be here shortly. We also have the Korean American Film Festival of New York, represented by Susie Lim. And we have Farewell Newsreel, represented by JT Takagi. We won't be here today without the help of all the volunteers in our group. I'm so proud of them and a bunch of really talented, passionate women that we've been meeting together. So if you're a member of this group, organization group, would you stand up, please? And well, we have a couple outside as well. So it's really a good effort that we were able to pull this thing together. Now that you kind of know who else is in the room, I'd like to know who you are, because this is our very first event. So perhaps by a show of hand, can you tell me, or maybe stand up. Actually, a member of ours asked me to ask people to stand up. And she asked me to do that because in this day, there's Kyung Yoon. In this day and age, we find that we often become, you know, we wear many hats. You're a cinematographer, you're a filmmaker, you're a writer, you're a director, and sometimes you even design your own website. Or you do your own marketing, your own branding. So by a show of hand, how many of you are writer-directors? Stand up. Stand up. Wow, okay. And how many of you are producers? Stand up. And how many of you are web designers? Okay, graphics designers? Okay. And who are some of these other people in the room so we know? Are you just interested? How many aspiring filmmakers are there in the room trying to make your first film? And students, great. And aspiring filmmakers, great. Okay. So we kind of know who's in the room. So I'll go on and tell you a little bit about who we are and how we got started. Now, I used to have a real job. I really did. I used to practice law in Silicon Valley for IBM for many years. And I had this idea of, you know, following my dream. Very vague. But I grew up thinking that, you know, our stories are not getting out there, and something that was in the back of my mind for a long time. And I thought about applying to film school. So I met Ang Lee at a fundraiser, sat next to him. And I said, "Hey, Ang, I'm thinking about applying to film school. What, do you have any advice for me?" And he kind of looked at me and he said, "Do you like your job?" I said, "You know, it's great. It's very heady to be an attorney in Silicon Valley. I loved it." Then he said, "Don't do it." He said, "Why would you ever leave your job like that?" He said, "It's really hard." And he basically went on to tell me how hard filmmaking was. Well, I thanked him, you know, and I concluded these filmmaking types are kind of depressing. I applied anyway, and I got into NYU graduate film school. Years later, I hosted him for a master class. So I brought him back to NYU, and I was driving him around. I said, hey, Ang, do you remember I actually met you years ago and you told me not to go to film school? And he said, you know, those who really want to do it, they always find their way. After I told him, he sounded like a fortune cookie. You know, he basically really summed it up really well for me. I mean, that's been my experience, and I think a lot of the filmmakers in the room will attest to that. It will test your resolve at every turn, and if you can be talked out of it, you probably shouldn't be doing it. Because I find myself, I've been doing it for about 15 years now, I've been tested over and over. How badly do I really want to do it? So he gave me great advice. 2 years ago, I met Yuna Hong and Kathy Huang, who happens to be in China at the moment, at the Asian American International Film Festival. We all had a feature documentary in the festival, John. That's where we met, and we were surprised. I think we were all in competition, in fact, against each other. But we were very surprised that we had not met before, and that we don't have a space, a dedicated space to really get to know each other. So we started meeting socially. About a year ago, I went to a thing called Women in the World Summit at Lincoln Center. It's a three-year convergence of people about women issues. And I heard some very troubling statistics for women worldwide. And even for the United States, for a place where half of the higher educations are populated by women, our numbers are terrible, especially in the higher echelons. And Hillary Clinton called it the 16% ghetto. That was the first time I heard that for women across all sectors. And it hasn't budged in the last 10 years. So we're stuck somewhere. And the numbers are worse for women CEOs, of course, about 3% for Fortune 500s. And so that really framed where I was in my career for me. So I wasn't going crazy. I went home and I did more research. I found more troubling numbers. I found that about 5% of women directors directed the top 250 films, about 5%, and that has also held steady. So we talk a lot about tech startups. We're at 8%. Women are 8% of women-led tech startups. And then I went into some of the Asian American women statistics. I learned that less than 1% of philanthropic dollars go to Asian Americans. Actually, it's half of 1%, yes.
Less than half of 1%.
And I also learned that young girls, Asian American girls between the ages of 15 and 24, has the highest suicide rate in the country against all age group and race. And also older Asian women over 65. After just going through all these numbers, I totally geeked out and I pounded out a 5-page document with a vision, a mission, and a bunch of these numbers, and I presented it to Yuna and to Kathy. I said, we need to do something. But I also needed them to really keep me honest. Do we need this? Do we really need this dedicated space to talk about these issues? I mean, what are we, in the seventh grade? Do we really need a group just to talk about these things? And I really need them to keep me honest. And they gently told me to kind of lay off the caffeine for a while. And then we really went to work. We got together every month, and we really thought about what we can do to change some of this. Us being content creators, what can we do? Well, number one, we can network to share information, share resources. It turns out most of us are first filmmakers in our homes and in our families. We're from immigrant families. So what is it that we need to learn to empower ourselves to do this? So we thought long and hard, and over the course of this past year, our group has grown. And we met our peers and our colleagues, and they have joined us in really trying to reach the same goal, is how do we really empower ourselves to tell these stories? And we are very varied. For instance, Teresa made a film about her dad. We tell personal stories. Kimi did one on environmental refugees. I mean, we have very different interests. But we were really bounded by the same urge to really tell our stories and trying to navigate how to do this. So some of the things that we want to do as a group, as we mature as a group, is we're hoping to have more forums like this to start a conversation, and hopefully this will become an ongoing conversation to address some of these issues we talked about. Some of the other things that we talked about is to have a high school program for girls, because it seems like a very pivotal point for them to see some role models, and so we were thinking about starting a film competition for high school girls to start early. And so these are a whole host of things that we've been talking about and thinking about what we want to do in the near future. So that's our group. With that, I'm going to start talking about our program. We have assembled here an amazing group of women, and it's not by design that they're all Asian American women, actually, but we're thrilled to have them. They're accomplished, interesting, and one of the things that we are united here tonight is not just by raising money to tell our stories, but also we're united by our very own stories. I remember growing up, we were really struck by our silence. You know, I don't think there were too many Asians on television. So I asked each one of them to prepare a little anecdote on what it was like for them to grow up as an Asian American girl and how the role of media may have affected their identity or their career choices.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here. I just want to start first by thanking the Asian American Women Media Makers for inviting me to participate this evening. When Casper first and Yuna emailed me, I thought, me? Really? Okay. I'll give it a shot. I really want to recognize what Casper, Yuna, and Kathy have done by, you know, forming this new organization. I'll talk about this a little bit more, but I was part of a founding group called the Asian Women Giving Circle, and it's all very motivated, I think, in the, you know, same motivations that Casper spoke about. But before I go off point, I know that I should first share my anecdote. So it begins with, I grew up in Northern California. I've lived in New York now for about 15 years. Our family was one of two Asian families that lived in our neighborhood, our community, including our public school. And the other Asian family was actually our family. It was our cousins who lived down the block. My parents, my mother and father, had immigrated from Taiwan in 1970. And I was first born, so I'm one of three children to my parents. And my father actually passed away when I was five. He had passed of stomach cancer. So here we were in what was West Sacramento, California, and the only Asians in our neighborhood. And my grandmother, my mother had actually sponsored her mother to come live with us so that she could go to work. And so she could take care of us, our grandmother, who did not speak English. And to say that my choices in terms of my professional, personal choices, how they've been shaped by my experience as a girl growing up it's like blaring. It's obvious, you know. It was one thing for me as the oldest to know what our neighbors were saying about us, you know, teasing and taunting and, you know, racism, was sort of a daily part of our lives. But it was a whole other experience, actually, to observe the taunting and teasing that was directed towards my grandmother, who didn't speak English or understand English, but clearly understood, you know, that the behavior was negative and was hurtful. And I know that, you know, she knows, you know, in many ways where it came from. The originations of that. And so that experience, I think, very much influenced, you know, my choices in terms of, both in terms of what I began to study in college. I was, like many Asians, particularly, I think, of immigrant families, I was the advocate in our family. My mother, you know, she went to work full-time as a nurse. but all the sort of responsibilities in terms of negotiating with school, anytime anything medical, came up, or hospital bills, you name it, that sort of was my responsibility, because my English, I was born in the United States, so I was able to sort of, you could say, more effectively communicate, and ultimately it was always advocating on behalf of our family. As far as the media, I think Casper already spoke to this, is back in 1970, there were no models, on television, in popular culture. Asian Pacific Americans, were invisible. I very much, I think, had a love-hate, relationship with media growing up. The hate part was, of course, either you were invisible, so you didn't see models of yourself, or the few glimpses that you were exposed to at the time were clearly, based on stereotypes, derogatory. This was at a time when people were still talking about, saw you as part of a lumping you together, with kung fu, dragon lady, or geisha, sort of the obvious ones. And then I had a love relationship with media, which is kind of interesting, actually. So in another part of Sacramento where I was growing, our family also lived, was I had two amazing cousins, Lisa Ling and Laura Ling. And Lisa is sort of more widely known now because she has her own show on the OWN network called Our America. Laura, her younger sister, also a journalist. Many people are familiar with, her experience when she was detained and imprisoned in North Korea several years ago. So we're very fortunate that she's, back with us. But some of the love relationship was that as growing up, I actually got to see, my fearless cousin Lisa, who were the exact same age, sort of break into media. And it was a local channel. It's called Scratch. The program. And then watch her sort of, propel herself as someone who has become sort of recognized, one of the few Asian women, including Laura as well, in media. But it's also been a really interesting experience because of sort of this pressure, I think, also to really mainstream. Is she, I use her as an example, is she seen as, a Asian Pacific American? Clearly she's, talented and recognized, and I see her as my cousin. But we have these conversations all the time about, with so few sort of Asian women in the media who are recognized, especially positively, like in her case, who are also, part of actually creating new narratives, about all types, different types of communities and experiences, it's still a big question. We all know, like the example of Margaret Cho, and, we can name probably less than, two hands, like sort of the recognizable, sort of more popular mainstream media figures. So I guess that's my sort of personal anecdote about, sort of what's my experience has been, and when we get into a little bit later, I'll talk about how that's really shaped my work with the Giving Circle and working particularly in the culture change sphere.
Yeah, this was the question I was up late last night wondering how I was going to answer. I think the question actually for me prompted questions about what community do you feel you're a part of? My family's Japanese. I'm Japanese American. I was born and raised in the suburbs of Philadelphia. But I was brought up in a predominantly Jewish community. Growing up, all of my friends, except for one of them, was Jewish. And that's actually a very essential part of my upbringing and where I feel comfortable in the world, which doesn't mean I'm not a Japanese American also. I was brought up by two parents who were very intrepid, very enthusiastic about living in the States. They got married and they met on a blind date and both wanted to move to the U.S. That was something that they had in common. They were both had artistic backgrounds. And my mother in particular was very, as the years progressed, she became more and more vocal and active in trying to challenge stereotypes about Japanese women in particular, in Japan and in the U.S., just in her own kind of way, in the choices that she made, in deciding to get a job, in deciding to buy a car so that she could build her own credit history, just in daily actions and comments growing up. I think what Angie said was interesting about being an advocate for her family, and I think being the second generation and trying to interpret the culture for your parents creates a really interesting kind of dynamic in your family and a kind of independence and a kind of affects the parent-child role in interesting ways that I think gave me a talent for interpreting, right, and translating culture and for figuring out how things work, a real satisfaction in figuring out how things work and sharing what I've found out, which I think translates in a lot of ways into my career choices. At the same time, I think it also... when you're in that role, sometimes it makes it hard for you to ask for help. And that's another reason that I think my career choice has been fortunate, too. I focus a lot on professional training and sharing information, and I think I learn just as much from other people as they learn from me, and being in an environment that enables learning helps me to learn. But in terms of just going back to community and, you know, feeling half my life like I was a Jew and half my life like I was, I don't know, sometimes Japanese, sometimes Jewish, sometimes, you know, nothing and everything in between. But really I think that, for me, my community is the arts. And I work in arts funding. I've worked in arts my entire life, and kind of talking about career choices. My parents were also Catholic. I was born Catholic, and it didn't take. I spent many weeks in church, and my family never met anyone in the church, never developed any relationships with anyone in the church, but they would go because my parents felt strongly about their religion. 7 years ago, I was in a performance art, I was an audience member in a performance art project by Nicola Dumit Estevez. It was presented by my organization, LMCC. And it was the culmination of a series of performance events that were modeled on pilgrimages, Christian pilgrimage journeys, but actually kind of transposed into the contemporary art world. So I was in an event that was modeled on the Last Supper, in which 13 artists and arts professionals were gathered in a room to talk about the arts and comment on the arts field generally. And it was structured sort of like a mass with hymns, et cetera, et cetera. And I found myself in there singing this hymn a contemporary composer had made for the event, standing, sitting, smiling, listening, participating in a way that I never had in many, many communities and contexts growing up. And what I didn't expect from being part of that project was that I would realize that the arts community was a place where I really felt at home, because I felt it was a place where there was inclusion across so many different kinds of backgrounds and interests and voices. I would say more than anything that's, you know, being exposed to the arts, being encouraged in the arts has led me to a place where I feel that I can make the most impact and I can meet the most diverse range of people, which doesn't mean that the arts community doesn't have a way to go itself. That's my story.
Hi. I'm Kyung Yoon. I was born in Korea and I came to America when I was 6 years old. I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. at a time when there were very few Asian American families. And I also remember the sense of invisibility growing up. And one of the things that I did, you know, because my name in Korean, you know, we say our last name first. So I was Yoon Kyung-bok, you know, 6 years old, landing in Arlington, Virginia. And when I introduced myself to other kids, they just were really making a lot of fun of my name, you know, like it was, you know, Kyung, you know, whatever. I mean, it was like every permutation and kind of, you know. So I decided one day that I was going to have a different name. It was not official. I just walked out the door. The next person who asked me my name, I said, I'm Karen. And so I became Karen Yoon, and that name stuck. As unofficial as it was, it's like right there next to my picture in my high school yearbook, Karen Yoon. And it's funny because actually there are many of you who know me in the room, and nobody has, you know, probably knows me as Karen. And so it's just because when I went off to college and I was like reading Roots and Alex Haley and my, you know, wrestling with my identity, and it was like this clean break, and I decided like when the next time somebody asked me my name, I said, I'm Kyung, you know, and I was like, Kyung Yoon. And so that was like the big break, and that was all good. Until many years later, and here's the media part, you know, I was really one of, I mean, not, of course not the only one, but, you know, totally affected by Connie Chung. I mean, it was huge to see Connie Chung on television, because for me, just to see somebody who looked like me, and Chung sounded kind of like Kyung, and it was all good. And I just, you know, and so actually she was the one who sparked this dream in me that, hey, I could maybe go into something like that as well. And so Casper talks about her, you know, big, you know, like chasing her dreams. I was like an economist at the World Bank, and it wasn't working out really well, and, you know, in terms of satisfaction. And I moved to New York in the late 80s with this, like, total lack of strategy, anything. It was just like, I want to be Connie Chung. And that was, and I knew nobody in the business, and I knew, you know, and if I had known any advice, I would never have come to the number one market, you know, to kind of break into television journalism. But, you know, it was, you know, ignorance is bliss sometimes. And so I wound up at Channel 5 when Fox Metro had just purchased Metro Media, and there were, like, some opportunities for somebody hungry and, you know, or whatever, just wanting to be Connie Chung, and that I wouldn't have had in one of the more established networks. So I was able to actually get my foot in the door as an unpaid intern, and the whole, all those things. I fetched coffee, and I ripped the scripts, and I worked my way up from, you know, and to actually becoming, you know, a field producer, news writer, and then on-air reporter. And I actually have the distinction of being the first Korean-American broadcast reporter in New York. And so media has played a big role. And just I want to just finish by saying that I totally recognize and applaud what you are doing, because, you know, community organizing is just really important. And whether, you know, it is about just one of the things I learned when I was, like, working as a journalist in the Fox 5 newsroom. I was really motivated to try to, you know, this was before I became a reporter. I was, you know, wanted to be a reporter. And I'd come into the newsroom on my days off, and I would kind of, like, study the scripts and who was a good writer, and I'd kind of try to find mentors, and I would go to the reporters that I liked their writing, and I'd say, I really like your writing, and can I tag along when you do a story? And some of those reporters were really nice to me and took me out on stories, you know, gave me pointers. And I would have to say that the one reporter who was, like, the least helpful to me, who shall, you know, remain nameless, was the only Asian reporter in the newsroom, you know. And it's not, when I look back, that there was anything wrong with that, you know, with that person. I just feel that it was really, like, operating in the dynamics that wasn't written anywhere, but everybody kind of knew that there was one Asian spot, you know, at that time. And so, of course, like, you know, I'm like, I'm younger, I'm, like, aggressive, you know, and, like, she's, you know, why would she really want to help me, right? And, in fact, it was when she left, I mean, she got another job at another market, and that I actually got that position, right? But at that time, the Asian American Journalists Association was starting. This is in the late 80s, and that was really exciting. Because for the first time, I saw my Australian news director running around the room because the AAJA convention was coming to New York. And he had to buy a table because ABC had a table and, you know, NBC had a table, so we had to have a table. And he had to fill 10 seats at that table. So he was kind of like, oh, we have Kyung, you know, and I'm like ripping scripts, and he's like pulling me, to, you know, to the table. And then he was like, oh, and there's Deepu, you know, like, and so he was just trying. He was very motivated to find 10 Asians and understanding that he needed to maybe hire more Asians. And so I understood, I started to understand that I've got to work really hard here, right? And to be prepared and to grab opportunities. But we also have to work not only in the micro framework, but in the macro framework of being able to influence the decision makers and to create incentives for to help our community, right? And so here fighting over the one spot that we're allowed to have and grateful for the crumbs, but we need to be at the place where we are creating more opportunities for all of us. And so I think that is like so powerful, and you know, and we can speak more about that later, and it also very much feeds into the work that I'm doing also as a funder in the Asian American community.
Well, I was interested by your anecdote about your name change, because I, in fact, did change my name.
Oh, can I just finish that one?
Yeah.
So I have to just say, I'm sorry. So the day came when I was actually going to start on television, and I was Kyung Yoon. Everyone knew me as Kyung, right? And some people advised me, but they said, you should have a more television-friendly name. And I said, well, I was called Karen Yoon, you know, when I was... And they're like, oh, you know, well, that's... And I purposely... I slept on it, and I made the decision that I would be Kyung Yoon. Because I remembered when I was a little girl, how would I have felt if I turned on the TV and seen somebody who had a name like mine? Mm-hmm. But more importantly, I was thinking about all those bullies. If they would see people like with my name on TV, that was really important. So I consciously made that decision. I remember having long conversations with Tiwa Chang about this too. And you know, ultimately, it's harder maybe for people to remember, but afterwards, they do remember you.
That my family was in the internment camps, my mother, grandmother, and all their crowd. But it was something that was never mentioned till I actually had to do a report about it for school. And the fact that that could be not in the history book, not talked about, such an element of shame in families, was really, that was, I guess, my turning point in terms of thinking, how could art history be see just disappeared? How could this happen? How could even the internment happen? And keep in mind, this could happen again. And things that have been happening recently ever since 9/11 make it very clear that this could happen again. But anyway, to go back, so those kind of elements, though, and the fact that when I was a teenager, the idea of an Asian American movement was part of in the air, and less so now, but it should be. So that, and the idea of being part of social change was very important. And so I see media as, I saw it more as a corollary to how do you work for social change rather than media itself. So I have sort of a different interest there. But it's just one short. As a kid, I remember one of my very strong feelings is when you saw all the media and magazines about makeup and things, I say, all the eyeliner. I have no place to put eyeliner. And that was a big trauma in my growing up. So.
Minette Louie is my original name, but people mispronounce it anyway because it's a weird Western name. And I have a couple of very quick anecdotes that sort of shaped my thinking about being Asian American in America. I was born in New York City and raised in Brooklyn till age 3, and then my family moved to Honolulu, Hawaii, where Asians are the majority. So I spent age 3 to age 8 in Hawaii. And but yet I was still, you know, pretty shy around. I was just a shy kid. And my mom was worried about that, and so she ended up putting me in a drama class, and I came out of my shell, started participating in class more. And then, you know, they decided to move back when I was 9 years old. They moved back, actually, because my dad is a painter, and he's like a watercolor painter, which is weird, but he used to sell paintings in Washington Square Park when we lived in New York. And then when we moved to Hawaii, he actually was a contracted artist with Crazy Shirts, and it's this like big retail chain on the West Coast, and so we did quite well, and we made decent money. And then at some point, his contract ended, he claims, because the new management was racist. So this sort of stuck in my mind as like, oh, okay, you know, this guy fired my dad because he was racist. And so we had to move back to New York to live with my grandparents in Brooklyn. And it was a miserable experience for me because going from Honolulu to Brooklyn is like kind of pretty obviously miserable. And I had a very hard time adjusting in third grade when I came back to New York because, you know, suddenly I was not the majority, the Asians were not majority anymore. And I went to public school in Brooklyn. It was a very mixed neighborhood. I grew up in Kensington, Brooklyn, so black kids, Hasidic Jews, white kids, Russians, a lot of immigrants. However, we still got discriminated against. The Asian kids still got discriminated against, so people would call me Ching Chong and Chink and whatever, and, like, this is something I was not used to at all, having grown up in Hawaii. So I was pretty miserable. And so that was a pretty formative experience in terms of just me wanting to work against, you know, other people's misperceptions of me just because I was an Asian female. And, you know, the main stereotype I've been working against when I was a kid is the quiet, demure Asian girl. So now I'm like the complete opposite of that. And there's another anecdote, actually. When I was 10 years old, we took a trip to Virginia to visit the Luray Caverns, my first time in the South ever. And, you know, it was, we took like a Chinese tour bus. This is really distracting, by the way. Can you guys hear me? Sorry. We took a Chinese tour bus, so it was like a, you know, a bus full of Chinese people, and the whole smelled like, you know, oranges. And so whenever we would stop and exit and look at a tourist site, everybody would look, you know, it was only black and white people in Virginia, so everybody would stare at us like we had horns coming out of our heads. And that was the first time, really, that a huge group of people would, like, stare at us. I mean, maybe this is, like, a group of, like, 50 Chinese people talking Chinese, mostly. And that just made me feel really, really uncomfortable, and I was just like, I can't believe these people are, like, looking at us like they're like we're aliens. And so that sort of affected how I thought about being Asian American in the U.S. And as far as how I came into film, I'd always been interested in producing specifically because, as I said, growing up in New York, you end up seeing a lot of film sets around town. And I was specifically interested in producing and not directing because I liked the business and the creative aspect of it. And I just loved watching movies growing up. You know, on my summer breaks, I literally would go to the video store and rent like 3 videos a day and watch feature films all the time. And so I knew how powerful films could be emotionally and how much cultural influence they could have. And so I was, I'd always been interested in it. I didn't do it until I was age 28 because I thought it was a very impractical thing to do. It still is a completely impractical and economically stupid thing to do. But I just couldn't, I love it. I love producing. I love making movies. And that's what I hope to keep doing.
Well, thanks so much. And that's the reason why I didn't put their nameplates up ahead. You know, I really enjoyed this idea of us sitting around sharing our stories that you don't really get to do. Sarah, would you put their nameplates on? Because I feel like we wear a lot of labels. We wear a lot of labels throughout our careers. And sometimes we're asking for money, sometimes we're not. I think over the course of our lives, some of us will be donating to stories or to projects. And I kind of see this to be a very fluid exchange that we have. And some of these stories, you know, I think would resonate with a lot of people in the audience as well of why we, you know, we don't hear these stories. We don't have a space for it. We don't have a forum. And I can also tell you a lot of the filmmakers in the group, that's really what's driving our passion is we really want to tell these stories. And we have internment camp and we have, you know, growing up being the only Chinese family in town. And, you know, we're really just trying to tell our stories. And so we're completely united by that, I feel like. I was going to have them talk a little bit about their work, but since you have to hand out in interest of time, I'm going to skip it a little bit. I'll just tell you that Manette turned out to be one of the most prolific producers I know, Asian American producers. She has just recently won an Independent Film Independent Spirit Award, the PAJA Producer Award. We're very proud, as you know, to have her in our community. JT, she turns out to be a veteran filmmaker. She takes risks, this woman. She makes films that would not be otherwise told. I think she made films about stories of people who are marginalized. And Kyung, a pioneering reporter, and she's also running one of the most interesting funds in the city now. And I think her organization was also recently written up in the New York Times about new philanthropy for Asian Americans. And Kay's organization, Kay runs one of the most best-kept secrets in town. She runs one of the best professional development programs as part of LMCC, which is to help artists in professional development. You don't get that very often. And talk about another connection. I learned about it from Yuna. Yuna, who went to one of her earlier sessions. And that's the value of this networking. And she told me about it, and she said, you should really apply for it. And I had a fantastic time. I feel like I learned a lot in her course. And Angie runs or is part of an organization that I highly admire. She runs the Asian Women Giving Circles, and it's a concept that has really, you know, it's time for us to really band together, and it inspires me to think about how they got started in somebody's living room just as much as how our group started with brunch in my living room. So you can read more about their professional work later on. I'm going to move on to the topic at hand, which is raising money to tell our stories. As you can imagine, it's a huge subject matter and it's complex, and we can easily spend a whole day on it. We're hoping at some point to have a follow-on to this panel to talk more about alternative funding, you know, for instance, crowdfunding and Kickstarter and the like. But for today, I'd like to focus the conversation on three different sections. We're going to talk a little bit about the landscape of where funds are. We're going to talk a little bit about the evaluation process, how each one of them evaluate funding and so forth. And then in the end, we're going to talk about practical tips and skills on how to ask for money. We're going to start. But let me frame this conversation about funding. It's changed a lot since I started film school, as digital technology has changed a lot of things in our lives. And for funding, as I said earlier, it's also changed a lot because now you can tap your audience in a different way. So the barrier to entry is much lower. Everybody's making movies, it seems. At Sundance, they had a record number of submissions, up to about 12,000. They took 65 shorts, and they took 119 features. So everybody's making making movies, but how do you get your scene? In terms of foundation money, and you can see that we don't have any large foundations here today, well, it's extremely competitive. If you respond to an open call for ITVS, you basically have about 1% shot in getting a grant. And that's pretty much the same for the Ford Foundation and large foundation. So the foundations represented here today are emerging organizations, and in Angie's case, they're evolving and they're... But they do fund film-related projects as well. So having framed that, I'm going to start with the foundation speakers to talk a little bit about how do you think the landscape has changed in your field over the years?
So I will have to start by saying I probably will have to defer to, you know, my fellow panelists in terms of the landscape and the shifting landscape, particularly around supporting the APA communities, because it's interesting. The Giving Circle, the Asian Women Giving Circle, is, you know, we're still relatively young. We were founded 8 years ago, five, six of us, and you know, the whole idea of the Giving Circle is that, you know, we were all, each of us, coming from sort of our own experiences, having worked in philanthropy. I, at the time, was at the New York Women's Foundation, where I was overseeing their grant making. And the New York Women's Foundation is a New York City-based community foundation. So it's not, you know, it doesn't rely on an endowment. It raised all its own money to support local grassroots community efforts to empower women and promote positive change. And interesting enough, being one of the few Asian women, actually, probably the only one, actually, at the foundation, but also in the broader community of, you know, Ford and you name it, you know, the other foundations, I didn't see myself sort of as identifying as an APA woman. You were there as, you know, a professional and a grant maker. But what began to emerge, both for myself and Coincidentally, two of the board members of the New York Women's Foundation who were Asian, Holly Lee and A. Young Choi, you know, it was almost like working in an environment where, you know, you knew that you were there supporting progressive ideas, supporting women, but yet we still recognized that we needed to create our own outlet, that we needed to actually organize amongst ourselves to try to devote more resources to the APA community. And sort of having, I think, partly because of our experience working and focusing on women's issues, it sort of became a natural transition that we would found the Asian Women Giving Circle. The interesting thing, though, is it's not just the fact that we were, you know, a group of Asian women who were going to fundraise, you know, person to person, very grassroots. It was why arts, why culture, why media? And, you know, Holly herself had been a, you know, she had been a filmmaker. I came at it, as I spoke a little bit earlier about, really from more having worked at the community level. So, you know, my entire professional career up to that point had been, you know, working as a tenant organizer, as an advocate, working with victims of violence, immigrant communities, very marginalized communities, both in Northern California and here in New York City. And then A. Young, someone longstanding who's, you know, very involved in the APA, you know, philanthropic and social service and community, you know, sort of just was sort of like a mother figure, you know, and had so much to bring. But the reason why we decided on why arts, why culture, is that it became really clear to us that, you know, it was just sort of recognizing this total invisibility, you know, that wherever we were, in whatever, you know, environment, even in the philanthropic community, that Asian issues, Asian women's issues, which are very diverse, clearly, because of, you know, the population, were not seen or heard. And so, you know, while we knew there were direct service programs, there were, you know, community building programs, that there were policy and advocacy, you know, organizations that were focused on APA issues, where, you know, it was sort of recognizing where are the, in some ways, like the messengers, the sirens, you know, the storytellers, the people that create new narratives. And that's when we decided, you know what, this is going to be our niche. You know, we don't know when we formed the group if we were going to, you know, even exist in a year. But we certainly, you know, we're going to give it our all. So we've been around for 8 years now. We've raised and given out just under $500,000 to support over 50 Asian women-led projects that, you know, meld arts, activism, education, and culture to advance, you know, positive social change for the APA community, particularly, you know, impacting Asian women. I can talk a little bit more about our, I guess, our grant-making process.
You know. In a minute, but can you just add a little bit as to whether or not you find yourself funding more media-related projects and why that might be?
Absolutely. So when we were founded 8 years ago, we certainly saw, you know, we have an open call for applications, so in part it depends on what we receive. So we do that once a year. And I've seen actually in that short time how our grant making has evolved. So even in the beginning when we were funding more, let's say, arts education, you know, sort of programs that were working through sort of using the medium of arts more directly, you know, with young people, let's say, while we continue to still support that work, we have found ourselves over the years really focusing on projects that, particularly film, you know, big media projects, performance pieces, you know, projects that are actually about, in some ways, you know, an individual voice that has a lot of potential to impact, you know, the bigger narrative. So, yeah, that certainly has evolved.
Great. And actually, many members of our group has received grants from the Asian Women Giving Circle and recipients. So thanks. Kay?
Talking about our grant strategy?
No, just a landscape of how it might have changed. Oh. Yeah, we're going to go into the strategy in a little bit.
Whole, I do a whole spiel on the funding landscape, and I'm not going to bore you with the whole thing, but I'll give you a couple of key points. One thing I wanted to say, though, because I don't know if we're going to get to it, LMCC's grant making focuses on the borough of Manhattan. We support artists and arts organizations throughout the borough to bring their arts out into the communities through the presentation of work, audience engagement, and participatory projects. We've found when we've done analyses of the kinds of projects that we've supported and the people, just the demographics of our applicants and grantees, and also our professional development programs, which go hand in hand with our funding, we found that women constitute 75% of our applicants, our grantees, and our workshop participants and workshop registrants, and men constitute 25%. And that's for many, many years. And in the professional development community, in the arts in New York City, that 75-25% split is very consistent. So I just want to say that as women in the arts community, women are participating, women are seeking resources, women are active. And I think it's just important to recognize that as well. You know, I think often we look at what we could still be doing, and that's important too, but I think women are doing a lot to advance their own goals, and I appreciate that every day, and I laugh at a comment at a fellow arts organization, a joke where someone, when they did the analysis, they said, wait a minute, you know, the underserved community here is white men. And that we need to reach more white men.
Can I just say one thing about that before I forget, though? I think that women apply to grants more, but they're not getting equity, which is where I'm the only narrative feature person here, and we rely on private equity in order to finance our films. Mm-hmm. So in the equity investment world, men are hugely favored.
So. And I'm talking from the perspective of a community funder. I mean, we really fund individual artists, emerging organizations, grassroots organizations that are grounded in their communities. And our processes, our outreach, and our funding are deeply consider the relationship of the applicant to the community that they're trying to reach. So for us, our applicant pool and our grantee pool are actually quite similar in demographic. And so our grantees are actually majority women. That being said, I'm supposed to talk about trends and other things too. So within the landscape, I just like to talk about broader numbers, and as a general funder, I look across the board at mostly arts giving, and I know that that's not necessarily all arts giving is not all media giving, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, talking about alternative sources of funding and how important individuals are and how they're thinking, creating new funding streams, I think it's relevant to just look at some of the dollar amounts that at the government level, you know, in the arts we're struggling to get back up to the levels that we were funding at in the 90s, at the national, state, local levels. New York City's budget this year is $155 million for arts and culture. The NEA's budget is $152 million for arts and culture. So we live in a city with a larger cultural budget than the nation. At the foundation level, you know, we're looking more at about $3 billion for the arts, which constitutes about 12% of giving generally, which is a better landscape. But when you look at individuals giving to the arts provide about $10 billion in support annually. And so I think that's really, you know, in terms of trends, that's a place where artists and creative people are really turning more directly to look at the resources that are available to them. There's a really interesting program, the East Bay Community Foundation piloted, which was a matching grant for artists who the foundation would match funds that artists raised from individuals. And what it was an incentivizing strategy to get artists out there asking the people that they knew and calling on their circles for support. And it was an extraordinarily successful, and I think crowdsourcing, Kickstarter, and these other alternative funding streams are showing us that too, and that you don't need a tax break to give to something that you care about. So those are just some trends that I wanted to share generally, talk a little bit about LMCC's grant making. In terms of, I've told you about our grant making in terms of women, Asian.
We're going to go into the grant making process in a little bit. Yeah, just a landscape.
Okay. So
they know what, yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, I actually was thinking that, and I was telling Casper that, you know, I'm kind of here and wearing a more than one hat, because I am the executive director and one of the founders of the Korean American Community Foundation. But I also just recently joined the board of Asian American Pacific Islanders in Philanthropy, and that is a national organization committed to advancing greater philanthropy in the API community and ensuring that more resources reach our community. And I bring that up because, like what Kay was just saying about just whatever vehicles that we may have to be able to empower ourselves and our community around, you know, certainly there's not enough dollars, but what, you know, we can do to promote more grassroots philanthropy and giving, because this is what matters to our community, and it's totally manifested by what Angie's work has been with Asian Women Giving Circle. You know, Angie was working at the New York Women's Foundation, you know, doing, I mean, and brings incredible expertise and perspective, but she and, you know, Holly and Aeung were able to really kind of zero in on seeing where the gaps are and what their interests and passions are too, and to create this, like, I mean, it's fantastic to think that they have been able to, you know, raise and give out like almost $500,000 that wouldn't have existed, you know, for our community and for, you know, women-led arts and activism if they hadn't gotten together in that living room 8 years ago. So APIP also, you should just be aware that launched in 2011 a campaign, which is a giving circle campaign. And the goal was to create 50 Asian-focused giving circles nationally by the year 2015. And right now, APIP is at about half of that goal, so 25 giving circles. And Asian Women Giving Circle is like the poster child, you know, of this campaign. Like they're the oldest, and you know what, and you know, and most, you know, dollars raised and given out. But there's like 25 more giving circles to go, and so APIP, and it could be a great resource if you, some of you in the room, you know, and I know we're talking about, you know, finding dollars and like to create like a movement among, you know, of a giving circle, let's say. If you're to work with through the APIP campaign, there's a lot of resources there, actually. They match 50% of whatever you raise in through this giving circle. And you can, and your giving circle members can choose like what it is that you feel is important to fund. And so it can be, you know, as broad or as narrow. I mean, you know, within, it's got to be kind of aligned to, you know, sort of API and community, but it's pretty, you know, I mean, as long as it's not like, you know, like about something illegal or something, I mean, you know, there's a lot of autonomy that is afforded to the participants. So anyway, it's just something to think about, and it's not just a 50% match. APIP has now two full-time staff members, and their whole job is to support the giving circle. So there's a lot of sort of best practice, support. They actually have this convening of all the giving circle leaders and to do training and to, you know, and there's a lot of support that way. So that's just, you know, one idea. And I think that is really speaks to the landscape picture, because from APIP's point of view, being a national organization, you know, we're kind of really seeing that there are tremendous gaps. Yes, there are like huge, you know, foundations, and we all know, you know, that as Casper says, you know, they're funding in the arts, but you know, we're just, so many of our community are not on the radar, and also don't have the capacity, you know, to be eligible even to be considered. So it's sort of like the rich always get richer, and I think we are kind of in this place where we can help to bridge some of those gaps. And I guess to KACF, Korean American Community Foundation, which I helped to start, it's been a little over 10 years. And we also started over a dinner with Korean Americans in the room. Some of us, you know, recognizing that in a funny way in our community that
we had never really grown up with a message about, you know, that it's important to give back. It was always, I don't know about you, but my message was always like, you know, go study, you know, be number one, get as far away out of this, you know, go, you know, away. And that was the definition of success. And it was not about sort of, you know, coming back and giving back. And so we wanted to create a vehicle for those of us who honestly had been recipients of the greatest investments, you know, of sacrifices of, you know, our parents and first generation. And here we were kind of making great inroads into, you know, different industries and becoming influencers in some ways, but then turning back and seeing that we were absolutely disconnected from our community. We didn't know that there were issues. We totally had bought into the model minority thing. We didn't, you know, so I was shocked to find out that, for example, you know, the senior citizen population of Asian Americans, of Korean Americans at that time in New York had doubled in 10 years, and that more than half of them lived under the poverty line. You know, I was shocked to find out about, like what Casper said, about the suicide rates among Asian American young girls. There's so much silence and stigma, and there is this, you know, convenient model minority myth that makes, you know, people who don't want to delve into whatever, you know, they think there's no problems or issues in our community. And okay, so why do we want to air dirty laundry about our community? It's not just, you know, to be masochistic. It's because resources do not get to you if you don't know that there are needs. So we need to have that voice and to establish that. So KACF, you know, our funding strategy is very much around ensuring more resources get to the underserved, the most marginalized, vulnerable members of our community. We fund organizations that are working with these populations. We don't have a strategy around arts and culture. However, we have, you know, one of our issue areas is around health, and we define that to include mental health. And so we are funding a conference on mental health issues in the Asian American community that we wouldn't have known about if Pearl Park, who had done this
one of our members film, who have a film
right called Can that is all about you know, breaking the silence around depression in our community, had come to us. And so we are able to, you know, partner with Pearl and funded the Korean American Film Festival and been a community partner to the Asian American Film Festival. But I will say, I mean, that has not been, you know, part of our overt strategy. But as we are growing and, you know, as we see alignments in the kind of work that is being done in our community around raising voice and visibility, I mean, we're evolving as well. So this is really helpful for me to be a part of this today.
It's also ongoing conversations that I like to have, because a lot of them are giving money to universities and museums and ballet, and they don't see why they would ever want to give money to an independent film. Or are we just not visible to the donors? Are we not making ourselves present in their, you know, when they're making these decisions? So I can see this to be a really long conversation, you know, among our communities and the media makers. I'm going to move on to our two media makers now, because they are on the forefront of hustling and pulling together money for their projects, and I would love to hear from you on how the landscape has changed, or how do you pull together equity, or how do you approach funding for your projects?
I'll just make a statement about, in terms of past, where we are now, the fact that there exist groups like CAM, the Center for Asian American Media, the National Black Programming Consortium, all stemmed out of activism and organizing of groups like people at Asian CineVision, Visual Communications in LA, where Asians and other groups realized there's public television wasn't serving a whole chunk of the public. We weren't seeing stories about Asians, African Americans, anybody. And so with a lot of pressure, Corporation for Public Broadcasting was, in fact, encouraged to start these minority, what they call minority consortiums. So now there's one exists for like Asians, Asian Pacific Americans, Native Americans, Latinos, a whole range, which makes it possible for, still not enough, but some productions to get funded and attempts to get the material on the air and sometimes succeeds and sometimes doesn't. The fact that ITVS exists is the same reason as that independents fought for it, testified in Congress for it, that, in fact, a lot of voices were missing from the landscape, and the Congress and CPB had a responsibility to address that, and that's why those things exist. So that idea that people can band together and pressure not only as filmmakers but as audience too, because, you know, programmers, they don't get any complaint letters about what they're seeing. They're not going to do anything either. So, like, but if a whole group of people are saying, we want to see blah, 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 that might make them think more. As Casper was saying, one issue for people now, of course, is that there are funds. I mean, ever since Michael Moore had showed that, in fact, you could make money off of documentaries and theatrical release, there has been more interest in documentaries. However, the barrier to making them has decreased so that with technology and the access of tiny cameras, a lot of people can make them, so that it is true the competition has become fiercer for those funds. I think one thing remains the same, though, that if you can even start your project, what a lot of people want, right, is that you can prove that you can do it. So it means kind of having something already, or at least a good sample of what it could be, is one of the biggest things that's going to make a difference, no matter who you go to at this point. And these alternative types of fundraising, I'm hearing from people who are doing all kinds of things, from having house parties to selling artwork to doing exchange things. And some of the Kickstarter things where you can say, you could be an associate producer on my film if you donate. And all those are, thinking different ways of how could you fund. But I think also thinking about working smaller. And I have to tell you that because I work as a sound person too, so I know about people's budgets. And producers across the board are saying they're getting less money to do the same thing, plus the digital component, which is your website, your social media, blah, blah, blah. All that has to come in for the same amount of money. Production rates haven't changed a whole lot. You're expected now to do a lot more with less funds. And I don't know if that will necessarily change, but I think what it does mean is that you have to be able to do a lot more. And most of you can do that as independents, right, that you should be able to kind of shoot, kind of do your sound, kind of do your social media, and at least know enough that you could get, so if a shoot comes up, you can handle it. At least that's my approach, that you should be able to do some of these things and not necessarily say, oh, I have to save all my money so I can hire the big-time DP and blah, 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 because then you'll be 10 years from now.
A lot of what you guys are saying is Greek to me, because I don't do docs. I only do narrative features. And unfortunately for us, the grants are not very available to narrative features. Only in recent years has the traditional grant-making organizations opened up to narrative features. So places like CineReach are giving, they financed Southern Wild and a bunch of other narrative features, but that's only started to happen in recent years. I got one grant from Jerome Foundation for a film that I did on Haitian immigrants, and which was a narrative feature. And I actually did apply to an Asian Women Giving Circle grant for a narrative feature about child trafficking in Singapore. Didn't get it, unfortunately. So I think that people, arts organizations, traditionally think of narrative features as very commercial enterprises, so we're forced to go seek equity to make our movies, and they generally cost more too because you have to pay a much bigger crew. In a word, the equity landscape for independent film is crap. It's and across the board, no matter what you are ethnically or female or male or whatever, it's really bad. And, you know, I could go on and on about why that is. I mean, I think the main reason is there's just a big dissection of audience because there's so much media available now on YouTube, Hulu, Netflix, cable TV, everything. You know, like theatrical revenue is going down, movies aren't being made anymore, TV is, you know, improving, and but audiences are really fragmented, so, you know, it's very hard to make money, very hard to justify a large budget on a film. So budgets are shrinking, as JT said, across the board, documentary and narrative. So what I would advise to you guys is that how do you raise money? First of all, don't wait around because it's going to take freaking forever. Lower your budgets, like really cut them down. And second of all, ask your friends and family first. I mean, literally, when I was raising money for my initial features, I would whip out my high school yearbook and go through it and see if people were working in investment banks, and I would email them and say, hey, I'm making a movie. I haven't talked to you in 10 years, but you want to give me some money. But, you know, the little known secret in independent film, in the narrative world, is that the vast, vast majority of first-time features are funded by friends and family because they are so risky. They're such risky ventures. Yeah, like nine. Yeah, I'm sure. It's nearly impossible to get like institutional financing for it, like established production companies or studios or whatever. It's very hard because a big part of this industry has to do with getting validation. So, you know, I had made a film called Children of Invention that was premiered at Sundance in 2009 about two Asian American children in Boston. Before that film got into Sundance, before I got the Sundance stamp, it was a lot harder for me to get people to listen to me and take my calls. And so we made that movie for very little money for a narrative feature. It was $150,000. And the financing came from two sources, half of which was a guy that the director went to college with, who had family money. And then the other half came from a company called Impact Partners, who some of you doc people might know because they finance social issue documentaries, and like The Cove and Born into Brothels and Queen of Versailles, great documentaries that Oscar nominated. Children of Invention was the first feature, narrative feature that they financed because it had issues of immigration and single motherhood and stuff. We were lucky to get this funding. We did it for really cheap. Luckily, we got into Sundance. And then from there, you know, hopefully you can capitalize on that validation and move on and do bigger things. And the other thing I would say about when you raise money, you really need to know who you're pitching to. Whether you're trying to find a producer for your project, you know, like know what they've done before, know what they're interested in, or trying to pitch to a financier, know what they're interested in. Do they like comedies? Do they like dramas? Do they like, you know, the actor that you have attached to your project? So you really have to tailor your pitch depending on who you're talking to.
That's great. That's a great segue for my next question, which is how do they evaluate projects and coming through their way for grants, or in Minette's case, how do you choose projects? And let me just frame that a little bit in terms of the metrics. I mean, there are many ways to decide on what is a successful application, what's a successful package. In some people measure it by how commercial it is, how much money they expect to make. And more increasingly, especially in the doc world, we talk a lot about social impact and how do you measure, how do you gauge social impact of a project. For most of us, the Asian American women media makers, we tell stories that are pretty close to home. Not all of us. Some of us do sci-fis. So we do have a wide range of interests. So I will start perhaps this time from this side on. Like, Minette, how do you decide what is a successful package or what is a project that you would want to take on?
Well, it's interesting. As a producer, I'm also artistic. I'm a creative producer. I think like a lot of writers and directors, your desires, what you want to make evolves. So, you know, in the beginning, I was really, I really just wanted to get my name out there and respected and my taste respected. And so that, you know, I could get into Sundance and things like that and be able to do other kinds of things. So I was limited by the budgets. I still am, but I was really limited by my budgets, and you can't really do like thriller or horror on $150,000. You know, you could do dramas. You could maybe do a comedy. So I, you know, started by making dramatic films, small dramatic films. Now I want to do more commercial stuff. Now I want to do the thrill. I'm actually in post-production on a crime thriller right now, actually the second feature by the guy who did Children of Invention. And it stars Bryan Cranston, and it's a, you know, much bigger feature than we had made Children of Invention for. And so now I definitely want to do stuff that is more commercial. If it has a social issue attached to it, great. But, you know, I think that folks like Justin Lin, who get to direct big features and cast minority actors in films that hundreds of millions of people will see and have influence over how people view a black guy and an Asian guy or whatever, and could see their interaction. That is how I feel that we can make a bigger impact. You know, I mean, I think that it's great. The number of people who saw Children of Invention for an independent film was great, but it's not as many people who saw Fast Five. So I think that, you know, getting to that level of filmmaking is really how you influence the culture.
You know, because we spend a lot of time of, you know, years of our lives once you do take on a project. What are the qualities that you're looking for when you do that?
Well, you have to be fascinated with the topic. You have to be willing to commit to it. Other than that, I don't really. I mean, every time I write a billion proposals, I get shocked when someone, oh my God, someone actually funded. So to me, it's always a shock and surprise. And I'm sort of the opposite in terms of, I mean, my main feeling is that there's room for all voices and all stories, and there's so many missing stories. And even if it's like, and you've seen this too, badly shot films, but really speaks to you. Sounds you can't even hear, but the film speaks to you.
All
right, somehow, and it changes your life. And I mean, I think that's the thing. These things can be life changing, and not only for audiences, but for the people who participate. Because in a lot of cases, it's people who haven't had a chance to tell their story. So, and I think if you are thinking in terms of what can you do, at least as a documentary person, so that's very different from narrative. Endeavors. I mean, it is possible to do it at a lower budget. So,
if the foundation speakers can also speak to what is your evaluation process for giving grants, you know, with the various considerations of social impact or commercial viability, and perhaps more specifically, you know, I think ideally you have the holy grail. Well, you have all of that. It's very commercial. It's very entertaining, and it has social impact. But do you find yourself, for instance, taking risk on something that, you know, is important? May you know, that it fills a certain gap. We have never seen it before. So I'd like you to talk about any of that.
So I'll talk a little bit about our evaluation process at the Giving Circle. I also just really feel that it's important for me to, you know, clarify, you know, we're not, you know, the Giving Circle is not a foundation. you know, and I every time I have the opportunity to speak to applicants who applied to the Giving Circle who didn't, for example, in the case of Minette, she referred to the proposal for her project, but I speak to folks all the time. You know, I always stress, because this is the truth, is that, you know, we are as grassroots as you get in terms of, you know, raising resources to support arts and culture. You know, we're entirely volunteer run, and so when we have our annual call for proposals, you know, we receive usually three times the amount of requests that we're able to fund. And in addition to, you know, of course, beyond just meeting sort of the mission criteria, you know, there's the other sort of elements that are considered, because we're not a film fund. So we don't just, for example, even though we may have gotten, you know, as I mentioned, we get more and more, actually, it's interesting, more proposals for documentaries and features, or narratives, and yet only probably 25% to 30% of those 10 grants a year are going to be awarded to support film, you know, documentaries, because the Giving Circle actually is invested in supporting, you know, projects that reflect a diversity of mediums, that reflect a diversity of issues. You know, I was actually really happy when Kyung mentioned how she was introduced to Can, Pearl Park's film, who's here, because that actually was really heartwarming, because the Giving Circle, you know, supported Pearl. But hearing, like, Kyung say that, you know, you learned about, you know, some of these issues through your film, and, you know, is actually a really important takeaway. for not just our work moving forward, but, you know, the kind of projects that we're able to support. And it really is a privilege, right? I mean, like, I enter sort of in the world of grant making, you know, and philanthropy as recognizing that, you know, like, I'm raising resources because of the privilege to be able to then partner in some way. It may be very small, it may represent a large majority of supporting, you know, really compelling work. So, you know, having worked in philanthropy and grant making where there's a lot of, you know, issues of power, you know, between recipients and funders and, you know, those issues, it's, I sort of come at it very differently. I've also been a fundraiser myself, you know, raising resources for the causes I believe in, individual film projects, you know, where I myself may not necessarily be able to be like a financer of a project, but how can I help that filmmaker connect to, you know, others who this might be something they're interested in, or serving on, you know, sort of various boards of organizations where I have to say when we get to like, you know, I know that Minette shared about how, you know, you find sort of how are you going to get the money? How do you, you know, bring yourself to ask? I mean, I could go on and on about that, but I would say if you're having a hard time, you know, pitching yourself, your work, you know, one consideration is actually to, you know, find a project that's separate from what you're doing, an organization that fundraising is actually a requirement. An expectation, you know, it does miracles for you when you're actually fundraising for something that you don't feel like is, you know, my project. And all of a sudden you begin to then translate those experiences to your own individual work. When it becomes, you know, it's almost like we need that separation to some degree, then to be able to become comfortable and confident enough to actually pitch yourself. It's unfortunate that it has to work that way, but I have actually found that's how I've become better at fundraising is, you know, through the various causes that I've been able to be a part of. So
we're actually going to ask that question next.
Okay.
On tips on fundraising. But let's wrap up the evaluation process for projects with Kay and...
So I should clarify, too, because I like that, you know, the word foundation doesn't actually apply to all people, all groups. LMCC is a nonprofit re-granting organization, and the funding that we provide, about $500,000 a year, is government funding. So we actually raise all of the resources that we give away, so we're fundraising constantly for our own programs and advocating for the programs. And because... it's public money, but actually whether or not the money is public or private that we're giving away, we run peer panel processes because we really believe in sourcing many opinions in the decision-making process for our applications. So all of our grant programs have discipline-specific panels. In the area of media arts, we actually have visual arts and media as one category with five panelists who are creators, producers, presenters, other knowledgeable individuals in the field who review the applications and make recommendations for support. I think because we give away public dollars, we get a lot of questions from artists and filmmakers about content and whether or not, as a funder, we're willing to take risks, if censorship is an issue, if political views are an issue. And unless there's an actual real direct conflict of interest with our mission or with our programs, and I can't say that's come up in the 8.5 years I've been at LMCC, that's part of the reason we believe in a peer panel process. Those issues really they haven't come up in our organization very much, and we really rely on the perspectives of knowledgeable folks on our panels to help us make decisions. So, you know, even though the work sample isn't the strongest thing and there's a spark there and there's something really compelling, we can make that decision and we can make that grant. And I think also as a program that often offers the first grants to many artists and allows individual artists to apply directly without a fiscal sponsor. We see it as part of our job to help people understand how our program works. We encourage questions. We give feedback. We take notes on our panel processes. And I think in general, you know, as I mentioned, we do a lot of professional development, and I think that especially in fundraising, what you don't know can drive you crazy. So we try to make the process as transparent as possible so that, you know, all these questions are not cycling through people's minds about why they might get cut out of a process. That being said, just from the media perspective, we're also a funder of the arts generally, and so we fund music, dance, theater, multidisciplinary, et cetera. And we really fund at the public engagement end of a project, and that's been something for us that's been a challenge, where we've sort of tracked the number of media projects we've been able to support over time, kind of said, you know, we have these restrictions about timing that make it hard for us to support filmmakers who are making work, although we have a filmmaking grantee here, Teresa, that we've been thrilled to support. You know, but we have to focus on projects that are in a post-production phase, and even then, our timelines and our flexibility is a little restricted by our originating funders at the city and state level. So we really see ourselves as a funder that's helping to get the work out to the public in the best way that we can.
I would just really second what Minette said, just speaking generally about really just doing your research, you know, before you approach a funder. I think it just saves you and everybody a lot of time, and because you just want to be sure that usually like a funder, you know, they'll have like their issue areas, you know, up, you know, on the website. Just take a look. Just make sure that whatever it is that you're pitching is really well aligned to the interests of the funder. And if there's like a little gray area, tweak it with their language and, you know, like so that it is really well aligned. And then I think the other thing, and this wouldn't really be true for like really, really large foundations. And I don't know, maybe Angie could speak to that. I mean, one of the things that our foundation really tries to do, because we are a foundation. We have professional staff, you know, we're not large, but we have a really experienced program, you know, staff. And we really invite like somebody calling and or sending an email before they submit an application. And just like anything else, you know, yes, you know, these decisions are, you know, there's like criteria and everything, but a lot of it is relational. And also that's all, you know, so that it really helps to try to make an appointment, come in, you know, if you have, before the thing is all, you know, your proposal is like really felt, formed and gelled, you know, try to, you know, have some conversations with the staff. You know, be open and, you know, but also, I mean, you've got your values, and it's not to say that you want to, I mean, because totally, like, we can also tell when, like, a applicant is sort of chasing the dollars and, like, kind of not, you know, like, you know, I mean, okay, I'll just say, you know, for us, like, sometimes, because we're the Korean American Community Foundation, you know, so sometimes we'll have, like, applicants who come to us and, you know, who have never really done anything in the Korean community, but then suddenly it's like, oh, they're a funder, and so like we love Koreans, you know, and we have them. They're like no partnerships, no grounding in the community, no knowledge, but they're just, you know, like and it just it's kind of like really obvious. So I mean, that's just an example, and just so I do think it's really important to kind of, you know, do that kind of research and also networking in whatever ways. I mean, it's true that, you know, that there are, you know, strict criteria. But then there are sort of, in the Asian community, there are like family foundations, there are, you know, and they're not that strict. Sometimes those are like really good prospects of like people who just, you know, your project can tug at their heartstring, or they might have, you know, family member who's affected by something that you are looking to delve into in your documentary. I mean, that kind of research and just kind of getting out there and having conversations and knowing, you know, where our community events. And I mean, it sounds very sort of, you know, roundabout, but I will say that that is how you build up your sort of relational capital. And then finally, I think like what Angie said about like maybe, you know, learning to fundraise for something other than your own projects can help you to become a better fundraiser. So there are opportunities to get involved with, you know, coalitions or communities. I will say also for KACF, we practice participatory grant making because part of our mission is not only to get more resources to the underserved in our community, but to raise up better philanthropists. So every year in our grant making cycle, we have open, you know, like, people can apply to join our community grants committee, and they have to commit to some training around community issues and also, but that you learn how to read a grant proposal. You get to go on a site visit under the, you know, together with our program staff. And in a way, I think sometimes having that kind of investing a little bit to train yourself on how to be a grant maker can also pay a lot of dividends when you're on the other side of having to submit grants.
Yeah. Castor, I'm sorry. Can I just add one thing? Because I realized that I didn't fully answer the question before about the evaluation process. So first, just want to make sure everyone knows they can go to AsianWomenGivingCircle.org where we have our application criteria up there. It's, you know, on the website. So I know I've already spoken about what our mission is, and but I wanted to add something that Ramanette actually reminded me of, which is this whole operationalizing aspect of your project. You know, almost 95%, I mean, 90 to 95% of the requests we receive are innovative, creative, compelling, in terms of the issues, in terms of the relatedness, you know, to the APA communities, where I think some of the more sort of, you know, where we see in the evaluative process of how we're, you know, going to decide which projects we can support, I think it's often in the operationalizing because, you know, sort of thinking through, and I don't want to get to the next question, right, you know, because I know we're going to get to that, but really thinking through, you know, sort of realistically, you know, what, you know, you're saying you're going to achieve, we'll get to audience, you know, that sort of what audience you're going to reach and how, with what budget and timeline. That's often, in my experience of reviewing these proposals, where it almost becomes like it becomes sort of almost obvious in some ways because the narratives before that, all the answers are sort of fully thought out and often lengthy. And then when you get to the operationalizing, all of a sudden it's sort of like, you know, simple sort of sparse bullets. And I think in part, I mean, understandably, you know, as often creative, you know, producers and artists, and we have this conversation all the time with applicants, is that you're already investing, you know, so much time and energy in, you know, the creative aspect. And now all of a sudden you're, of course, and many people are well-versed, but not everyone's sort of expected to be a business manager, the fundraiser, the outreach person, you know, knowing the markets. And that's just so many hats, you know, to have to wear. But I do believe that where we're going to get better in terms of actually getting bigger dollars, not, you know, just the Asian Women Giving Circle, you know, $8,000 to $10,000 grants, is by getting better at how we present, you know, our case. And so I don't want to get too far into this, but I think, you know, in part, it will mean actually also making the case for why media, why arts, why culture, why the APA community. And, you know, that's just a lot to have to, of course, you know, take on, but that is, in essence, like, you know, I feel like partly all of our calling if we're, you know, about either creating or supporting, you know, more work like this, you know, for the mainstream.
Great. We're rapidly running out of time, and I had wanted to open the conversation to audience questions. And one of the outstanding questions we're going to talk about is, you know, any tips and etiquettes for asking for money that has worked for you. So if you guys can keep it to like a very short answer, just to you know, what has worked for you? Let's say you've done your research, you've built some relationship. You know, with that question, and you know, we can move on to the audience question. How's that?
Be succinct. Be passionate and enthusiastic. Be conversational, and know what you're talking about.
I think working up what they call the elevator pitch is important, and a lot of groups have workshops on that, and it's actually hard to do, and it's terrifying, but if you can do that, that's the best thing in terms of being able to say succinct, but also making the point really fast without going, and then, and if you're one of those multiple production type people, like when you go to HBO, I haven't had to do it, but I have heard a lot of friends, you better have like 10 pitches, because they go, oh, we did that. Oh, boring. We had to come up with the next one really fast. So, anyway.
Oh, in the those are all good. In the continuum, don't be afraid to ask. Because sometimes I find that I'm in a, you know, in a situation, and I'm a funder. I totally know why we're here and why we're having this conversation. And then I find, and I think it's maybe an Asian thing, but we're like, it's almost like I want to like get to the point and say a number, you know, and say what it is that would be done with that number. And one thing that I will say is if you say a number and they agree to it right away, you've pitched it too low. You should say a number and there should be a pause. And this is like an agonizing moment of silence. But then if they say yes, you'll know that it was good. Because if they didn't have to think about it, you asked too low.
Oh, can I just before we keep going, I'll say in any, especially social issue documentary, the more groups you are allied with, community groups who you know are going to use your film, who you can get the support from at the beginning, who would say, yes, we need a film like this, and our 20 chapters would use this if it was available, all those things help also.
That's so important. I think that's right, about just having allies as well. As much as you can say you're so good, the more people you can have who are credible to the you know, to the target, saying she or he is really good, that is a big help.
Use your own voice. People really love to hear the voice of the creator. I agree with everything everybody else said, and so I'm going to fill in something else, which is like practice, have a buddy. Go to training programs. You're not on your own. Ask people for help. Run your applications past other people, somebody who knows nothing about what you're doing. The questions they ask you are the questions that other people will ask. It's not rocket science, and a lot of feedback can really help you. And pitch value, not need.
So all of those are such great tips. I think the only thing I have to add is, you know, start building your community of interest for your project from the very beginning. And by community of interest, I don't mean just people you think might donate, partners, allies, who themselves then are people you can go to through your development process that will also be approaching their colleagues and their networks to support, you know, your work. And the other piece, which might seem really obvious, but be a consumer of the media that you know you're working to create. Yuna Hong, you know, who's here, I know part of the founding group. Her documentary on Anna Mae Wong is premiering in May on public television during APA month, and you know we should all be supporting each other. And I think you know tonight's forum is a great example of that. You know, sort of. We're not networking enough. We're not, you know, sort of connecting across all these different kinds of, you know, mediums and issues. And so the more we can do that, I mean, we also become more visible as, you know, a constituency that needs to be recognized. And I'll just, I know this was mentioned earlier, but use, which I'm sure everyone is, but use social media. The Nielsen reports that have come out in the last year about consumer, you know, behavior, television, you know, in terms of the market of APAs, if that's your target audience, make sure that you know all about them. And so that's all available online at Nielsen, not to mention, you know, APAs are the largest segment of sort of what they consider multicultural populations that view, purchase on through social media. Hulu is incredibly popular amongst APAs. So that's all I'm going to add.
So I think this is a good time for us to open questions from the audience. Yes?
Grants for them that supported my career.
Wow.
10 to 15 years.
Nice.
Wow. I want to talk to you afterwards.
I think what I'm primarily really interested in hearing suggestions for is sort of at a certain point the funding caps and you're operating at a certain budget for a number of years and you have to feel like you're moving forward. Similar to the statistics of the percentages of people working within the industry. So what are some suggestions or methodologies of breaking through the ceilings both for funding and for various careers?
Can everybody hear the question? How do you break the ceiling, I guess, for funding?
Are you a documentary filmmaker?
No.
Oh.
I work in theater and
okay. Well, I don't know about docs. I don't really know about funding caps in the doc world. But in narrative, if you want, you know, I've made 8 feature films now. Each one is progressively higher budgeted than the previous. And I think it's just, it was just a natural, organic thing. You know, I have repeat investors, which is great. But you're constantly looking for new sources of funding. So literally, like, way too much of my time is spent looking for money. Unfortunately, because it sucks to have to, you know, talk. I waste a lot of time talking to potential investors who don't end up putting in any money and actually waste my time and try to pick my brain. But, you know, it's a necessary thing that you have to do to, like, sort through all of that and try to find the you know, 1 to 2% of people out of all the people you talk to who will actually write a check.
Did you want to?
How to break the ceiling?
Do you have an answer?
I mean, that's a really good question, Rana, and I wish I knew the answer. I mean, there's a lot of ceilings we're talking about too.
Yeah.
You know, so we're trying as well in our own, you know, way, whether in the private sort of philanthropy world. So I think we're all part of, like, trying to actually push some of the more traditional foundations, even within, you know, like, our own communities, to recognize, you know, the value and importance of this work, let alone trying to actually...
And then I'll add something at the end there.
I think, you know, again, in the narrative world, since money talks, like, in order to get repeat investors, you have to return their investment or they're not going to invest in you again. So, I mean, that is where the commerciality aspect comes in. You know, I love making movies about social issues. I really do. A lot of times don't make the money back. So you have to start doing some more commercial films so that you return your money back and you incurred repeat investment.
I'm just going to fill another niche and continue to talk about professional development, because I think that, you know, and on the topic of there are many ceilings, external and sort of personal, and while there are opportunities to sort of build on success and strategies to sort of go to the next step on particular projects, etc., I think there's also a value to thinking strategically about your career and your artistic and personal trajectory overall. Something I care deeply about is the sustainability of artists and creative people in New York City, and that those kind of plateaus can happen on personal levels and on creative levels. And, you know, strategic planning processes and programs can really help you kind of get clarity around what are all of the different pieces of your life that could be contributing to your next project, moving your vision forward. Is the thing that's right in front of you the thing that is, you know, is putting all of your energy into that one thing going to be the best strategy to bring your work to the next level? Maybe, maybe not, but I just recommend those kinds of thinking processes in terms of setting your own goals in addition to sort of learning how to navigate the realities of these negotiations and these complex asks as well. So just...
Yeah, you know, I think it's so interesting because what you're asking, you know, it is about, you know, for this audience of, like, you know, media makers and women, and we're Asian American, and yet I think so many of us, you know, these are just such challenges, I think, in across many fields and across, and so I mean, you know, it's maybe being so generalist, but I found, you know, when I was a journalist, and that was so interesting because, like, you don't go into journalism because you're shy and introverted, right? So we were already like the self-selected group of probably the most big mouth, aggressive, curious, you know, Asian Americans who are lousy at math. And yet I was in this like leadership program that was sponsored by AAJA. And so when the teacher, whatever, trainer, Ron Brown, he asked us, you know, he was like, so, you know, how many of you in this room would like, you know, would say you would, you know, you'd like shy away from going after your source or your story? And we were like, oh, none of us, you know. And then he asked the question, how many of you would use that, you know, would say that that's the same kind of attitude you have about asking for your raise? And all of us were like, you know, because we felt like there was something very noble in going after our story, but somehow to further ourselves or to say, I'm really good. I mean, we just had like a lot of sort of cultural barriers around that. And we actually really enjoyed, and why we had pursued this field was that we wanted to write and we wanted to, you know, like uncover truths. And I think many of the same, but what we really didn't want to do was have to go schmooze with the news director or with, you know, and what we saw was that a lot of our colleagues who weren't necessarily the best writers, but were out, like, you know, networking a lot, you know, were the ones that were getting ahead. So I just will say that I think that sometimes, you know, when you talk about hitting a ceiling and about, like, it's really important, even though it's out of your comfort zone, get out of your sort of, you know, the safe kind of environment, and because you've got to expand your networks and you've got to have wider groups of people, you know, appreciating and also being those allies who can maybe, you know, speak for you and help you. So again, it's, I know it's so trite to be about networking, but almost write that into your job description for the day. You know, that if you're going to spend 50% of your time, you know, doing your actual work, that another 50% is about how many 3 new contacts, who are you going to have coffee with? And because sometimes I know, and I'm pretty extroverted, but I find that really hard. But once I kind of said, well, that's just part of my job, it really makes it easy because I also have to fundraise because we also have to raise everything that we give out as well.
If the panelist is willing, we'll take 2 more questions perhaps. Yeah, in the front.
I know you wanted to save sort of crowdfunding thing for another time, but I just wanted to start a conversation about I'm currently fundraising for my first narrative feature, and I participated in this pinch competition at CanFest, and I found that it was really difficult to go beyond my own circle of acquaintances. And I know the word that we've been using a lot in the last few years is about curation, and I wanted to know your thoughts on, you know, a lot of my classmates have, you know, they've gotten to Sundance Labs or IFP, and when you have that stamp of approval, it's easy for someone to say, okay, this is a project that's worth backing. And I was screening the first 10 minutes of my feature as a short, and at every Q&A, people thought, oh, this is great. Well, how do we see more? Why don't we see more films with Asian American protagonists? And so I know there's an audience for it. How do we move beyond this, you know, the, say, a few hundred people I actually know personally, and we get into the community and we get people who want to back these things, you know?
I don't know, man.
And that was nice enough to retweet.
We'll start with Minette. Well, it goes back to what Hyung said about networking. You know, go like meet all, like everyone and anyone, and, you know, talk to the guy next to you sitting on the plane. I mean, that's what I have to do as a producer. It's like I'm looking everywhere for money, everywhere. So, you know, like, you know, don't be afraid of being annoying, because that's your job to do that when you're fundraising. I mean, not like obviously annoying, but
And, you know, there was a time when I was seeking development funding, actually, for another feature that, you know, the one I mentioned earlier about child trafficking in Singapore. And I literally just, you know, Googled a bunch of Asian organizations, nonprofits all over America, and I emailed all of them. And I said, hey, do you want to give me some money? You know, give me like $1,000 for development money so I can, because you need money to get money. You need money to raise money. So, you know, I needed money to like travel to Singapore and like scout and like, you know, figure out how to make this movie. So you just really have to think outside the box. And Kickstarter, I have to say, it's great in some cases, but there is such an oversaturation of people of doing, everyone and their mother does. I mean, I literally get 10 emails a day saying, hey, you can contribute to my Kickstarter. So I feel like that is sort of tapering off in popularity, and you just have to think outside the box, always, constantly.
I would like to add to that. And maybe, see, one of the things that I've found that's been really helpful for you know, for my organization to be a foundation, even though, you know, we're not giving at the levels of a Ford or Robin Hood or whatever, but being a funder gets you at the table with other funders, right? So, for example, and, you know, this is totally not films, but after Hurricane Sandy, like, I attended this funders briefing for, you know, that was organized by the mayor's office for, on, for, APA communities that were, you know, that were hurt, that were affected. So I was like sitting next to this guy who was from the Robin Hood Foundation, and so we started talking, and then I said, "Oh, you know, so we're doing a lot of funding around Korea and APA." And he was like, "Oh, this is great!" And you know, they were about to have their 12/12 concert. He had to move a lot of money, you know, quickly, and it was really helpful to him to meet somebody who had their ear to the ground and could actually direct him to like good organizations that are doing impactful work in the APA community. So, in fact, through that connection, 2 weeks later, this like Korean like Sandy Relief Committee got a $75,000 grant from Robin Hood, right? And so, I feel like there is a point to what I'm saying, that if it's possible, like when you're saying that you've got your 300 friends, like if you can think strategically about, you know, really like getting the confidence of maybe some strategic people who might be able to get in a room with others. So they might not be able to fund you, but would be able to help connect you. That there is a convening power. So that I think, you know, I know that. Does that make sense? Like, I think
call the producer.
Oh, is that what it is in your field? Okay. Yeah. So talk to Manette.
Connection. I see a lot of women here, and I'm very happy to be here because I'm very happy to see that there's a lot of Asian filmmakers, that I didn't know. I'm part of an organization called New York Community Film and Television, and I really feel that there's a need to get together. I didn't know there were so many of you. I'm really, in a way, upset to see that all of you are here and may not be part of now, because it's something that now it misses, but I think that's something that you miss also. Because I think in order to be powerful, you need to get together with bigger organizations,
yeah,
and have them also do their part in terms of helping you. It's a give and take. I was part of, I was on the board, so I have to say, and my thing was membership. And my thing as a filmmaker and as a filmmaker of color and as a woman filmmaker is to see more of women Asian, of women African. I'm African. I don't see African. I'm just as invisible as you are. So I think the more of us talking and getting together is very important. And I think all of you should be talking about it.
Yeah, there are actually about three of us. Kimi, myself, and Pearl are also members of NYWIFT, and perhaps another. and Teresa. So we have talked about having a presence in the mainstream media.
About 20,
yeah.
And I think I was telling you, now we should have been supporting this event.
Right.
We didn't know about it, and I think all of this event should be in connection with each other. More power to all of us.
Yeah.
But we need to think about it that way. You know. to be of color, to be invisible. I think that's crazy.
Yeah.
I think we need to do more about that, all of us.
Yeah, that's absolutely something that we're striving to do as we mature, as we grow as a group, and to have more of a presence in an organization like NYWIFT as well. One last question. Yes?
Yeah, it's more just about, and it's related to networking, but Sam Pollard talks about this a lot, who's a big documentary filmmaker, is that it's about help. You have to, it's a give and take, right? So you can't just say, oh, I need help, but you have to be willing to help other people too. You have to be supportive of other people. Network, not just network because it's going to help you, but in fact, it will make an impact on other people. And I think also the more that you support other filmmakers, whether it's working on their film, helping them fundraise, give talks, mentor someone else, that all comes back to you. So.
That's great. Well, on that note, this is our very first event, so I'm thrilled that you guys can join us. And one more round of applause for our panelists for...